Welcome back to The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeological artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last episode, we opened Season 3 with a discussion of the Great Schism between the Holy Roman Empire in the West and the Byzantine Empire in the East. We saw the Seljuk Turks rise to challenge the supremacy of the Byzantines, eventually becoming such a threat that the Byzantine and Holy Roman Empires joined forces to launch the First Crusade. We spent much of the rest of last week's episode exploring the devastating impact this crusade had on the Jewish communities across the Rhineland, and learned of some of the notable Jewish figures who were alive at the time, including the famous Rashi. This week, we will see how the fallout from the First Crusade shaped a rapidly rising tide of anti-Semitism across Ashkenaz. We will meet an even more fervent Muslim faction who would take over Spain from the Almoravids, and we will meet some colorful Jewish characters, including many strong and powerful women, and a man who would become one of the most celebrated Jewish scholars of all time. In the summer of 1099 CE, the First Crusade came to an end, with the Christian Crusaders taking control of Jerusalem. On their long march east, they had conquered a whole bunch of land from the Seljuk Turks, on which they had established a number of new Christian states. These included the Kingdom of Jerusalem, a feudal kingdom encompassing basically all of Israel and the Sinai, as well as the Kingdom of Armenia, the Principality of Antioch, and the counties of Tripoli and Edessa. Added together, these states made up a large chunk of territory, which would require a lot of manpower to defend. But after the fall of Jerusalem, most of the knights and commoners, exhausted from their years-long crusade, returned home to their families, leaving just a handful of people to actually defend the newly conquered Christian land. In the following decades, numerous back-and-forth battles between the new Christian states and the surrounding Seljuk Turks took place, with neither side gaining much ground over the other. But in 1144 CE, the Seljuks were successful in taking back control of the county of Edessa from the Crusaders, under the leadership of a veteran Turkic warrior named Zengi. This decisive takeover of Edessa sparked a panic amongst Christian Europe, who began to fear that, in its battle with Christendom, Islam was gaining the upper hand. This moral panic sparked the Pope to launch a second crusade the following year. Just as with the First Crusade, the Pope's initial edict was quickly spread by popular Christian figure, this time a French abbot named Bernard de Clairvaux. Pretty soon, some notable royalty got on board as well, including King Louis VII of France and Emperor Conrad III of Germany. The Crusaders officially set off once more in 1147 CE to take back Edessa and fight the growing Muslim powers in Spain. But unlike the First Crusade, which ended triumphantly with the conquering of Jerusalem, the Second Crusade sort of just petered out after a series of defeats at the hands of the Turks. By its end in 1149 CE, the Christian establishment was left licking its wounds, and the Turkic Muslims were feeling pretty good about themselves. In the following decades, things only got worse for the Crusader enterprise. All around the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the centerpiece of the Crusader states, an up-and-coming Muslim ruler named Nur al-Din was amassing territory, slowly uniting the various Muslim tribes in the area. In 1164, al-Din sent a lieutenant along with his own nephew, Saladin, to meet with the Fatimid Caliphate in Egypt in an attempt to further consolidate Muslim power in the region. This meeting of the two great Muslim leaders left Almoric, the Christian king of Jerusalem, worried that a powerful Muslim alliance could be a threat to his kingdom. And so he turned to the Byzantines for help. As it happens, King Almoric was right to be afraid. By 1171, just as the Byzantine army was on its way to help defend Jerusalem, Saladin officially took control of Egypt, ending the Fatimid Caliphate and bringing to life the Muslim superpower that Almoric had been afraid of. Over the next two decades, Saladin and his Muslim army conquered nearly the entire kingdom of Jerusalem, as well as a good chunk of the county of Tripoli and Principality of Antioch. As you can perhaps imagine, the fallout from the First and Second Crusades left Europe and the Middle East in a state of significant tension. In the Christian lands of the Holy Roman and Byzantine empires, ordinary citizens and religious and political leaders were dejected after the failed Second Crusade, and the economy had suffered a significant blow as well. In the Muslim lands to the east, the ever-present threat of another Christian attack loomed, and leaders became increasingly zealous, embarking on forced conversion missions which left any non-Muslims vulnerable. This tense political situation was piled on top of an already fraught political system in Europe, which enforced big class differences between lords and peasants, leading to rampant poverty, violence, and disease. All of this hardship created the perfect conditions for a spike in Jew hatred. As we know from last season, suspicions and rumors about Jews killing Gentiles had been swirling under the surface for centuries. But with the First Crusade, the Church was given license to take these rumors much more seriously, and with deadly consequences. The first documented medieval accusation of Jews committing ritual murder occurred in 1144 in the English town of Bury St. Edmunds, where the body of a 12-year-old Christian boy was found in the woods on Palm Sunday. A rumor rapidly spread across town that a secret society of Jews had lured the boy to the woods and then crucified him. This false accusation got the whole town riled up, and a violent mob gathered, out for Jewish blood. The situation became so dangerous that the local sheriff had to shelter the local Jews in his castle to prevent a massacre. The Jews were saved, but the boy's tomb continued to be a holy site for the Christians for years. Over the coming decades, there would be an explosion of these vile anti-Jewish rumors, which became more and more outrageous, finally culminating in charges of blood libel and host desecration, which we will learn more about soon. But the tide of ruthless anti-Semitism would not go unchallenged. In 1138 CE, in Muslim-controlled Spain, a Jewish boy was born who would become a champion of the Jewish people, and would distinguish himself as a leader in Jewish thought, philosophy, and science. His name was Moshe ben Maimon, but he is better known today as Maimonides. Maimonides, meaning son of Maimon, was born to Rabbi Maimon ben Yosef in the Spanish city of Cordova. His family spoke Arabic and Hebrew and were fully practicing Jews, with his father actively involved in Cordoba's Jewish community. However, when he was just 10 years old, a new group of fanatical Muslims called the Almohades rode down from the Atlas Mountains to conquer Cordoba from the Almoravids. The Almohades were even more militant than their predecessors, and their mission was to cleanse the Muslim world of all non-believers. The Almohad conquest was brutal, with waves of violence, destruction of synagogues and Jewish communities, and forced conversions undertaken upon Christians and Jews alike. Under Almohad rule, Muslims and Jews were forbidden from being in the same house at the same time. Jews were forced to wear long, black, shapeless robes that dragged in the dirt behind them, and the jaliyah, that special tax non-Muslims had to pay to remain in Muslim territory, was reinstituted. Maimonides' family initially managed to continue practicing Judaism in secret at home, while pretending to be Muslims in public. But the year he turned 21, the family had had enough and moved to Morocco, settling in the city of Fez. Fez was a very large city, with a population of around 200,000 and a sizable Jewish community. During their time there, Maimonides began to study Torah under Rabbi Judah ibn Shoshan, and even spent some time in nearby Tunisia studying medicine, specializing in the study of poisons and their antidotes. But as the years passed, Morocco too became more and more intolerant, and in 1165, when Maimonides was 27 years old, his mentor, Rabbi Judah, was sentenced to death simply for being openly Jewish. The wave of anti-Jewish violence and forced conversions was incredibly concerning to the world's Jews, and there was much discussion in the community about how to handle it. One prominent rabbi decreed that it was better to commit suicide than to accept forced conversion to Islam. But Maimonides was deeply troubled by this decree and decided to write an open letter in response, titled Igeret Hashamad, or Letter on Abandoning One's Religion. In his response, which was written in Judeo-Arabic, Maimonides passionately argued that as long as one remained a Jewish in their heart and intended to return to Jewish practice eventually, it was far better to live by the Torah than to die by it. In fact, he argued, nearly all of the commandments of the Torah should be allowed to be broken in order to save a life, an idea now known as pikuach nefesh. His argument rested on the idea that, if you're dead, it's impossible to fulfill any mitzvot, plus you would be wasting the God-given gift of life. To give you a better sense of Maimonides' ethic, let me read you a quote from his letter. If a man has been scrupulous in his conduct, gentle in his conversation, pleasant towards his fellow creatures, affable when receiving them, not retorting even when affronted, courteous to all, even those who treat him with disdain, conducting business with integrity, devoted to the Torah, wrapped in the talit, crowned with tefillin, avoiding extremes and exaggerations, then such a man has sanctified God. In fact, the only commandments that Maimonides felt rose above the idea of pikuach nefesh were murder, idolatry, and rape. It is clear that Maimonides' Jewish ideology and ethical mind stemmed from his family's early experiences as refugees, having fled from forced conversion both in Cordoba and Fez. But Maimonides' family was not alone. His letter resonated with Jews both in Spain, where the Almohades were engaged in waves of murder and forced conversion, and in Ashkenaz, where the Second Crusade was raging. Maimonides ended his letter by advising that the best way to deal with the threat of forced conversion is to pick up and move somewhere where you can practice your Judaism freely, especially if that place is the land of Israel. It wasn't long before Maimonides' family followed their son's advice and moved once again, this time from Fez to Israel. This was a big move, and not an easy one to make. Although Jews were technically allowed to enter Israel, traveling there was highly dangerous. The trip from Morocco required travel by land to one of the North African ports, followed by a month-long sea voyage. The ships carrying travelers bound for Israel would hold up to 400 people at once, all squashed into the ship's cabin, along with animals and other cargo, which was very cramped. Maimonides and his family arrived at the port city of Akko in Israel in May of 1165 and traveled for 6 months before finally making their way to Jerusalem. Unfortunately, the trip was marred by the death of Maimonides' father, and just 1 year after his arrival, Maimonides decided to leave the Holy Land, traveling south to Egypt. Jewish migration to Egypt was actually not uncommon. Many of the Jews who were fleeing the persecution of the Almohades in the Maghreb had settled in Fustat, Egypt, which was controlled by the Shiite Fatimid Caliphate. Maimonides quickly found work there as a doctor to one of the caliphate's most powerful men, Al-Qadi al-Fadil, the caliph's right-hand man. Moshe not only tended to the health of the vizier and caliph, but was even sent as an emissary to the kingdom of Jerusalem to tend to the Christian king Almeric. After the takeover of Jerusalem by Saladin and his Sunni army in 1173, Maimonides was able to retain his job as personal physician to Al-Fadil and was accepted into Saladin's new Ayyubid dynasty. Maimonides got married in his mid-30s and settled down. He prayed at the nearby Babylonian shul and gained much respect within the Jewish community there. In fact, people began to refer to him as Rav or Rabbi, and he would be called on to pass judgments on various she'elot as a member of the religious court. For a short time, he even became Ra'is al-Yahudiya, or head of the Egyptian Jewish community. With all of this responsibility, Maimonides' days were packed, to say the least. In one of his letters, he wrote about his daily routine. Quote, "I dwell in Fustat while the king Saladin lives in Cairo, and there are 4,000 cubits, two Sabbath limits, separating the two, somewhat over a mile. I have a very difficult appointment to the king. I have to see him at the beginning of every day. When he is weak or one of his sons or concubines are sick, I cannot leave Cairo and spend most of the day in the palace. Then I have to attend to the officers of the king as well every day. One or two of them are invariably ill, and I have to see to their treatment. So in sum, I go up to Cairo every morning, and if there are no mishaps, I get back to Fustat by midday. As soon as I arrive, ravenously hungry, I find the halls of my house packed with Gentiles, the grand and the humble, judges and magistrates, a mixed crowd who all know exactly when I am showing up. I get down from my mount, wash my hands, and go and persuade them to wait a little while I manage a light meal. Then I go to heal them and write whatever prescriptions they need. Sometimes they are coming and going all hours until the evening falls, and sometimes my fatigue is so great that I have to speak to them while lying down. When night falls, I am so totally exhausted that I can't say a word. The result of all this is that no Israelite can manage to speak to me except on the Sabbath, when they all come after the morning prayer, and I instruct the community on what should be done for the coming week. They study light matters until noon, then go on their way. But some come back and study again until the evening service. So this is what my daily schedule is like, and I have told you only some of what you would actually see. With the help of God, may He be exalted. Unquote. Just as Maimonides was rising as a prominent Jewish figure in Egypt, anti-Jewish violence was reaching a crescendo in Christian Europe. In the French city of Blois, in 1171, a man who had been letting his horse drink from the river saw a Jew drop an untanned animal hide into the water. But the Frenchman somehow mistook the animal skin for the body of a child and reported the incident to Count Theobald, a nobleman in charge of the area. The count decided that the Jew's fate would be decided by a water ordeal, a medieval form of Christian justice in which the accused would be tied up and thrown into a river that had been blessed by priests. Because the blessed river was supposed to reject evil, if the Jew floated and survived, he would be found guilty, while drowning would deem him innocent. The Jew somehow miraculously survived the ordeal, which unfortunately sealed a guilty verdict, not just for himself, but for all the Jews of the city. 30 of Blois' Jews were subsequently arrested and imprisoned, and, soon after, were burned alive in the market square. This mass killing of Jews so outraged the Jews of Paris that they issued a letter to the King of France, Louis VII, demanding justice. King Louis responded, warning that if the Count had acted unjustly, he would be punished. He wrote, quote, "Now, you Jews of my land, you have no cause for alarm over what the prosecutor has done in this domain. People leveled the same accusation at the Jews of Pontoise and Joinville, and when the charges were brought before me, they were found to be false. Be assured, Jews in my land, I harbor no such suspicion. Even if a body were discovered in the city or in the countryside, I should say nothing to the Jews in that regard." Unquote. But anti-Jewish rhetoric and violence was not just limited to France. It was rapidly spreading throughout Christian Europe. In the town of Lynn, in Norfolk, a rumor that a newly converted Christian was chased into a church by Jews led to a massacre. In Stamford, during the annual fair, a boy who had deposited money with a Jew was killed by a robber, and somehow the crowd figured it was the Jew's fault, again leading to the slaughter of many Jews in the town. As the Crusades continued, Christians became ever more convinced that the Jews would stop at nothing to prevent one of their own from being converted, which led to all sorts of horrible stories. In particular, stories of mock crucifixions on Passover abounded, eventually coming to include the detail of the Jews' consumption of the Christian victim's blood, a myth known as the blood libel. A famous story written by William of Malmesbury, an English historian, became the prototype of a different kind of anti-Jewish myth, that of the boy martyr. In this particular story, which gained wide acceptance throughout medieval Europe, a Jewish man who suspected his son of having taken communion with a Christian friend attempted to burn him to death in the oven. However, of course, the Mother Mary appeared to the boy, lowering the temperature and saving his life. Over the next several decades, stories of boy martyrs popped up everywhere. There was the cult of Robert of Bury, created in 1181, ultimately leading to a massacre of Jews 9 years later. There was Adam of Bristol, who was purportedly lured into the bathroom by a Jew and killed. In London, rumors of a boy found in a churchyard with a Hebrew inscription cut into his flesh sparked outrage. And on it went. In 1189, London played host to the next Jewish massacre, this time coincident with the coronation of the new English king, Richard the Lionheart. To congratulate the new king and present him with some gifts, a group of Jewish leaders from various English towns had made their way to London to see him. However, at the time, Jews were banned from entering Westminster Abbey while a new king was being crowned. The gatekeeper tried to stop them from entering, starting a scuffle which quickly developed into a full-on riot. By the end of it, 30 of the visiting Jews had died, either beaten to death or trampled by the gathering mob. But things only escalated from there. A rumor began to spread throughout London that the king had ordered all Jews in the city to be executed. An angry mob quickly gathered, and London's Jews fled back to their houses and locked themselves inside. But unfortunately, their houses were not fireproof. The crowd burned the entire Jewish quarter with the Jews inside, with the fire ultimately consuming much of the city. Once the flames had died down, the crowd tore through the Jewish quarter, plundering homes, and stealing the Jews' valuable belongings. A similar massacre occurred less than 6 months later in the town of York, just before Passover. News of all of this anti-Jewish violence quickly reached the ears of Maimonides in Fustat, culminating in a letter he received in 1172 from the Jewish community in Yemen, describing a brutal campaign of forced conversion by Muslim rebels. As part of this conversion, the Muslim rebels laid out a series of arguments to try to persuade Jews to join them voluntarily, arguments that actually seemed to be working. This compelled Maimonides to write a second letter, called An Epistle to Yemen, in which he lays out his rebuttals to the Muslim argument and makes a strong case for the Jews of Yemen maintaining their religion. He goes on to suggest that the roots of Jew hatred lay in the insecurity of other religions in the face of the wonder of Judaism. Just like his first letter, the epistle to Yemen went viral, becoming widely circulated across the Jewish world. But it was not just his political commentary that was gaining widespread interest. Maimonides was a prolific writer, both in the areas of medicine and Jewish philosophy. Inside his medical texts, which are still available today, Maimonides wrote about the epidemiology of diabetes, described cures for pneumonia, treatments for various venomous animal bites, and methods of treating depression. And then, of course, were his philosophical and religious works. Perhaps the most famous of these were The Guide to the Perplexed and the Mishneh Torah, a comprehensive commentary on the entire Torah, written in basic Hebrew to create a practical guide for Jewish living. Maimonides' innovation was the combination of Jewish theology with principles of Greek and Latin philosophy and logic, something that had not really been done before. Maimonides felt that this grounding of Jewish principles in Western ideas would strengthen Judaism against attack from Christian or Muslim powers. Maimonides' tenets of living a good Jewish life touched on many spheres of existence, but centered themselves on kindness and humility. For example, he wrote that one should not ask someone to dinner knowing they cannot make it, and that when one disagrees with someone, they should never do it in such a way that shames or humiliates the other person. He advised against flattering others, unless it was genuine, and advised everyone to live within their means and avoid splurging. In business, he felt it was crucial that employers pay their employees on time, and that salespeople should be upfront about any flaws with the product they're selling. He felt very strongly about the importance of not only caring for the poor, but doing so with dignity. He wrote that the most sacred mitzvah regarding charity is never to make the recipient feel less than, and that to find employment for the poor is paramount so they can sustain themselves and be self-sufficient. He also championed the modern method of Jewish burial in a simple shroud and plain pine box. This uniform burial for everyone, regardless of their station in life, meant that the poor would not be further humiliated in death. He also took religious ritual itself very seriously. He famously suggested that every Jew should handwrite their own Torah scroll so that it would become a part of them. He also had some very practical suggestions, such as making sure to live in a town or village that had a physician, a surgeon, a bathhouse, a bathroom, reliable water source, a school, a scribe, an honest treasurer, and a legal court. With the publication of the Epistle to Yemen, Maimonides seemed to be reaching a peak of fame and renown. But the following year, his brother David, whose income as a gem trader had paid the bills while Maimonides worked on his philosophical writing, drowned during one of his trading journeys, leaving Maimonides crippled with depression for years. He finally died in 1204 CE. Despite his fame, Maimonides' work was not universally accepted. In fact, it was highly contentious. The main issues that fellow Jewish scholars had with his work were its over-reliance on Greek philosophy, the lack of citations to back up his religious conclusions, and a general sense of arrogance that he could reinterpret or reimagine the Torah. As we will see next week, this criticism of Maimonides would wind up making major waves in medieval Europe, and would ultimately lead to Judaism itself being put on trial. And that's where we'll leave off for this episode. Next week, we will look ahead and examine Jewish life in the 12th and 13th centuries. That's all coming up on The Jewish Story.